all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
Yeah, good afternoon, good evening, and good morning, whatever time that you're around the world and you're listening to Veterans Radio, because we are broadcasting around the world. That's right. You can find us on our website, those of you that are listening on our landline, WAAM Talk 1600, right in the garden spot of the Midwest, Ann Arbor, Michigan. But if you want to tell your relatives, friends, they can go to www.veteransradio.net. There's a whole bunch of stuff you can get on our website. Yeah, we have a lot to talk. And with me right now is my partner, and been with me, I've known you longer than a lot of folks in my life, Dale Throneberry. Dale, baby.
Good afternoon, Bob, and good afternoon to all of our Veterans Radio listeners. We appreciate and really are grateful for your tuning into the program. We are honored to tell our stories to you.
Absolutely. And boy, we got one today, Fallujah. That's a name that, along with Baghdad, you think of Fallujah, right? I mean, when you think of I don't even want to say the war in Iraq, this ongoing saga in Iraq, you think of Fallujah.
Well, I can tell you, if there's, 10 years this thing went on, or has been going on, and we have a lot of friends here locally that participated in the Battle of Fallujah, and they keep talking about it. I mean, it's something that was deadly. It was menacing, brutal. It was door to door, window to window, house to house, just, for weeks and weeks upon over and over again, it seemed like. I can't imagine. I'm grateful that I wasn't there. But these men and women going into these houses, and I'm sure we're going to get into this more. We'll save our comments for your guests. But that thing went on for 6 weeks, solid.
It's I wish that there was some way that we could somehow do what you are there with. So that just a plain talk about it doesn't grab the emotion. Well, it was really tough. Well, how tough is tough? Well, I guess we're going to find all that out, because our guest today is Vincent Folk, F-O-U-L-K, Vincent L. Folk, and he is the author of The Battle for Fallujah, Occupation, Resistance, and Stalemate in the War in Iraq. Oh, boy, that's going to say a lot of something. But before we get to that, do we have any laundry here we got to take care of?
Well, the only laundry that we have is is to just make sure that people go to the Veterans Radio website. If you'd like to contribute to Veterans Radio, you can make a contribution there, and as a result of your contribution, you may actually get the Veterans Radio, the best of Veterans Radio, the Vietnam stories that we got available to our listeners if they want to do that. You can also follow us on Facebook. There's a lot of things going on Facebook, and also on Twitter.
When you do contribute $25, that's the minimum. Come on, folks, $25. What is that? A couple beers in one of those fancy stores there.
A couple of craft beers, right?
Yeah, there you go. Craft beer, craft bar, craft everything. You got it. But that $25 is the minimum. We'd certainly like to hear from you on that, because this is our own way of doing our own GoFundMe, right, Dale?
Well, it certainly is a way to do it. And
they're coming in already. Stuff's coming in.
We want to thank all the people that have contributed, and the books are flying out of our warehouse in Bob's basement, and to make sure that everybody will...
A lot of other things flying out of there, too.
That we can get to you. We're going to be coming up with some other giveaways also for our donors. So stay tuned and see what else we can come up with. We've got some shirts
That truly. If you like what we're doing, and our mission is to give a voice to the vet, if you think that's this is really cool, what can I do? Well, this is what you can do, and you will get something back. Again, Dale said Vietnam stories, the best of Veterans Radio. That's our first edition. We're going to be doing others. Korean War, the Middle East, Right. And we got Vietnam, and that there's going to be others coming. So $25, of course, you can make it out for more if you'd like. That's going to be our budget. This is going to keep us going for the next year right here on Wham Talk 1600. So
absolutely.
We want to hear.
Absolutely.
So go to the website. There's a button there. You can click on that. It gives you all the information, and we hope to hear. You're just going to have to give my mailman a bad back. That's right. I want him to look like Santa coming up the walkway with his bag full of $25 checks. Boy, that'd be really cool. And then we can start, because we got all kinds of things looking forward to do in 2015. One of the events that we want and really are working on is in June to broadcast from Cape Cod.
Well, why not?
And my good friend, and I know he's listening out there, Fred Socio. Freddie, he says, I'm gonna serve you some saltwater clams that doesn't have a grain of sand in them. Now, you guys from the East, Dale, you're from the East. What does that mean? I mean, I know it means no sand, but how can you have a clam without any sand? Tell me that.
It's a lot of rinsing, I'll tell you that. But, it's going to be exciting. If it all comes to fruition sometime toward the end of June, that we'll be out on Cape Cod and eating lobster and shrimp and telling stories,
and
telling more and more and more stories. And this is what we want to do, and this is why we're asking you to contribute to Veterans Radio so we can make these trips out and around the country and talk to different veterans in different areas. So, you know, we can find out what's happening out there, and you can tell us. You can always send us an email or on our website, click on Contact Us, and tell us what you would like to hear on the story. We've been getting a lot of contacts from people who want us to play their music, that want to talk about their adventures, I guess you could say, in the military, and we're trying to get to you. We're only on once a week, but boy, we got a lot of stories.
And how about if you have a special event like they're going to have out there at Cape
right?
Cod? It's in Sandwich, by the way. I guess that must be somewhere in England, but it's in
after
it's on
the
Cape.
The
yep.
Earl there.
Sandwich.
Sandwich Island.
Massachusetts, there we are.
Okay.
They contacted us. And if you have an event coming up, contact us. Go to our website, www.veteransradio.net, and all the contact information. Tell us about your event, and you say, well, we'd like to have you guys come in here and broadcast live. Well, we can do that, but we got to hear about it first. Give us plenty of information ahead of time. We'd really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Boy, that was a goodie. Right. And what's coming up now is Tet. This is the anniversary of Tet. January 30th, 1968, the American Army and Navy and Marines and Air Force and the U.S. got caught with their knickers down. They certainly did on that. It was a truce in Vietnam. It's a regular religious holiday. It's a, I believe it's a Buddhist holiday. Tet, right, Dale? You were in Vietnam.
I was. It's an annual holiday, as you say, 3 days of celebrating, and there was a ceasefire set up for that. And although we did get caught, as you say, a little bit unprepared, we certainly made them pay the price for what they did. And I'm sure you're going to. You have somebody that you want to bring on, don't you?
Yes, I do. And with me, besides yourself, is Mr. Mike Updike. There we are. Sound bites from Mike Updike. Mike and I went to high school together. We had lunch about a month ago, and we started talking about I'll tell you what. I'm going to ask Mike. Mike, are you there? Welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi, Bob. Yes, I am there.
We pulled it off, Mike. I told you we'd do this.
I never had any doubt.
Mike and I go back about, a few decades ago in high school, now Redford High School, which no longer exists, leveled, but that's okay. And Mike started, Mike, why don't you tell our audience, what is it that you did in Vietnam?
Well, even though I was trained as a quartermaster officer, when I got to Vietnam, I was assigned to an ammunition battalion at Cameron Bay, and they had just set up what was called the Ammunition Operations Center to control ammo operations in central Vietnam. And I was one of the three lieutenants. We were headed by a captain, but I was one of the three lieutenants who basically were the OICs, the officers in charge. And since I was the senior lieutenant, I ended up running the night shift, which was from 6 at night to 6 in the morning.
Okay, so here it comes, close to January. Well, but before we get back, Mike, hang on. I want to ask Dale. Dale was in, were you in basic?
No, I was in primary flight school at the time.
So
I
you're was, getting ready to
I
be
was
a
out
chopper
in Texas.
Pilot.
I was just starting to learn how to fly at that time.
And that was at Rucker?
No, this was at Fort Walters, Texas.
Okay, and what happened when TEP came down to you?
Well, not a whole lot, except we read the news and saw the news on television and so forth, and we just said, well, maybe they're going to expedite our training a little bit to get us over there faster, which didn't occur. But I think it was kind of a surprise that this happened, that it was such an effective campaign by the communists to attack over 100 cities. At the same point, about 80,000 troops were coming in. I mean, we should have been aware of it. I mean, they were coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and through history, we saw this buildup coming, but we just didn't anticipate that it would happen to this amount. I wasn't there. Mike, you were there.
Oh, yes. And basically, I agree with everything you said. We were completely caught by surprise. I was in Vietnam the whole year, and we ran ammo 24/7, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And the day Tet hit was the only day in my whole year tour when we had no shipments coming in and no shipments going out. We just had our troops doing re-warehousing,
Why do you think that was, Mike?
Well, I think it was because we didn't have an idea what was going on.
Okay. Does it sound like maybe there was a little rumor or that?
Well, what did happen was, it, like I said, that the whole night was just deadly dull. And I sent the night crew, the sergeants and the enlisted men, I sent them in early. And so I was just getting closing things up, and I was going to go, as soon as the day crew came in, I was going to go back and have my dinner, which was breakfast, and then go to sleep. And, I would say it was just about 15 minutes before the day crew was due in, I got a call from my opposite number at Long Bend in the 3rd Ordnance Battalion. And he asked me if I could arrange a shipment of about 50 tons of small arms to the White Mice, the Vietnamese National Police down in Saigon. And we did this all the time. One of the three ammo battalions would be short of ammo or overworked or something, and another battalion would pick up the slack. And so I said, yeah, sure, give me the details and I'll take care of it. And so he did, and then he said, have you heard of anything going on up north? And I said, no, it's as quiet as a tomb here. He said, well, there's some chatter going on around here that something's going on up north. And I said, well, I haven't heard anything. And so then the day crew came in, and by chance our captain was on R&R and actually was getting engaged in Hawaii, and so the day crew was run by another lieutenant. And so I briefed him, and then I went in and I got breakfast, and I went to sleep. And I woke up about 2 or 2:30 in the afternoon, and in our BOQ area was just in chaos. And I should explain, I'm a pretty sound sleeper, so I missed the first few hours of it. But it was just in chaos. Everybody running around, some guys in combat gear and the whole nine yards, and so I called the AOC, and I got one of our sergeants, and I said, what's going on? And he said, sir, the blank has hit the fan. The country's coming apart at the seams. Can you come in early? And I said, yes, of course.
Was there explosions going on while you were waking
well,
up?
Well, yes. Cameron Bay was attacked.
Now, remember, hang on a second. Folks, this was a super large base, and Mike was in the ammo dump for the base. He distributed ammunition, bombs, rifles to all of Vietnam. He's a big target. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, I actually at the time I didn't think about it, but you're right. And the main damage they did was Viet Cong sappers had penetrated the base, and they did manage to seriously damage an oil tanker in the harbor. But they did not get to any of our pads, our ammo pads.
Why do you think that was?
It's hard to say. We were pretty well protected where we were because we were on a peninsula, and so it was harder for them to infiltrate. And we also were in the area protected by, I think it was the White Horse Division of the South Korean Army. And those boys were pretty good. You know, we supplied them with ammo, and they had good liaison officers. And I really wouldn't want to go up against the South Korean Army. They're pretty good Joes. And I think that was part of the reason they were a pretty good covering force for us.
And, well, were you scared? I mean,
you know, it's one of those things.
I gotta ask that.
As soon as I talked with the sergeant, who was a good man, all of our sergeants were older than all of the officers, and they were very experienced, and they really looked out for us. I mean, I can't say enough about them. But anyway, it was one of those things where I was more numb than scared. You know, I thought, well, you can imagine what I was thinking. I know this is radio, so you don't want me to use certain words, but I was thinking,
please,
holy
don't.
Blank, how did I get in this thing?
And, well, okay, in so here you are. If that base were to go up, I mean, it would be 4th of July for the next 10 years, I'm sure.
Oh, God, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And after it was authenticated, you were told to activate a specific defense plan.
That happened later. That happened in May when the air base was attacked.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But,
well, did you have a defense plan during TET?
We did have one, but it was not activated because the sappers that were sent in, the Viet Cong sappers, we captured most of them, and frankly, they really didn't have much trouble ratting out on what was going on. I was not part of that interrogation or anything, but that's what I was told by our intelligence officer. And we decided that we were safe enough so that, and frankly, at that point, we were the only ammo depot still functioning. The 184th at Quinion was compromised, and then 3rd Ordnance at Long Bend was compromised, so it was up to us. So we really did not want to allocate any resources away from the ammo business of getting ammo out to the troops.
Mike, this is Dale. I was stationed in Long Bend. I wasn't there during TET 1, but my cohorts who were there, you know, during TET said that the Long Bend dump got blown up. Looked like a 4th of July for a week.
I believe that is the case. You know, I have to tell you one thing was that at the time, we were so focused on our particular mission that we really couldn't keep track of what was going on in the rest of the country or the rest of the world, to be honest with you.
Right.
So it was just, it was, everybody was working 18-hour shifts, and frankly,
they were busy.
It was just,
they were busy.
Our
helicopter company, I forget the number of hours that they put on aircraft during the TET offensive, but in talking to those guys, they were flying 12, 14, 16 hours a day.
How many missions would that be?
That could be anywhere from, you know, 5 to 40 of them, because our missions, you know, sometimes they're different than jets. A day. I mean, you're flying.
You would fly five missions a day?
Well, you're flying 16 hours, and they just send you from point A to point B and then to C and D. And if you were doing a lot of medevacs, you'd go out, pick up people, bring them back, and immediately get in a helicopter and go back out and do some more stuff. Or you'd have to take troops, because the idea of the helicopters was that we could move large numbers of troops out into the plain of reeds northwest of Saigon and block the North Vietnamese from coming in. And they were all over the place, from what I understand. We did that story with, I think it was a guy named Wendell Skinner and Major Carlson, because they got shot down the night before TET. And then he said, you know, we got a little distracted the next day and weren't able to keep up with each other. But in talking to the other pilots that were there when I got to Vietnam, they said it was just hard work and a little bit chaotic. But, you know, eventually they put everything together and drove these guys out.
But
yeah, it took about 6 weeks. We were,
yep,
from February 1st through really the middle of March, we were on 18-hour shifts. And the one thing I want to say about my comrades, we didn't have a single complaint. Nobody complained about the work. Everybody pulled their oars just as hard as they could. And
that's the American military there,
yep.
Mike. You know that, and I know that, and Dale knows that, and so do a lot of our veteran listeners. That's the American military. I don't want to hear any of this garbage about, well, anyway, you know, I don't want to hear that. Mike, would you come back? We got just about 30 seconds of this segment. Would you come back and tell us a little bit more about being the ammo guy in charge of that and the Bob Hope, Dale was also part of that. He saw Bob Hope.
I'd be happy to, Bob.
How many thousand feet did you see Bob Hope?
5,000, as close as I could get to him.
Okay.
I got you beat. I was within 10 feet of him.
I was a new guy in town, so I didn't get to go to the show.
Thanks again, Mike Updike, for being our guest. And Mike retired, by the way. He was the oldest. What were you? What was your?
I was the oldest lieutenant colonel in the United States Army at one point.
Ooh, we got to get to that on another program. Would you come back, Mike?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you very much for being a guest, and take care.
Okay. You too, Bob.
Thanks.
Bye bye.
Oh, woo, boy, that's fast stuff, man. 25 minutes. Boom, goes right fast. Let's hit that spot, and then we'll be right back with our guest and the author of Battle for Fallujah. Well, okay, pushing buttons and moving levers doesn't always, yeah, okay, we're going to have to pick up on that, and that's our little spot, some legal help for veterans. Right now, my next guest is the author of The Battle for Fallujah, Occupation, Resistance, and Stalemate in the War in Iraq. Vincent L. Falk. Did I say that right, Vince?
You said that right.
Oh, cool. Okay. Is the author. He was prosecutor. He's a prosecutor in Florida. He was a colonel in the Army, Civil Affairs. Oh, that sounds interesting. Civil Affairs, holy moly. Served in Iraq as a deputy commander of the 308 Civil Affairs Brigade in 2003 and 2004. He talked about fraud, waste, and abuse in Iraq. He was investigating it. He was an advisor for the Inspector General of the Afghan National Police. Currently an attorney in Ohio. Hey, by the way, are you getting any snow right now?
Oh, yes. The snow is coming. It hasn't quite fallen yet.
Oh, boy.
But you can see it coming.
Okay. Well, all right. So he is currently living in Ohio and a prosecutor. He's been a prosecutor in Florida. And we want to welcome Vincent L. Falk to Veterans Radio. Vince, I'm going to get right into Fallujah. And who's got Fallujah now?
In charge? Fallujah. Yeah, exactly. Right now, Fallujah is firmly in control of the self-described Islamic State or Caliphate. It is the center of operations we have several names for it, but ISIS seems to be what most people understand it to be, from which they are attacking a very tenuous controlled Ramadi, which is the capital of the Anbar. It's still in the hands of the Iraqi army, but it's barely. And from there, it's also being used as a base to attack Baghdad with car bombs.
And is it in Sunni hands, Shia hands? Who's got?
Oh, it's firmly in the Sunni hands, and
it's in Sunni hands.
Yes, in Sunni hands, and they are intent on driving out the Shia from Iraq.
Okay. I know. Dale just raised his eyes. We've got about 3 minutes before the halfway break, but I want to, because we were told by Bing West, now I'm sure this is true, but it's all chaotic, the whole region is, the whole country, that the Shia were the ones in charge, the Sunnis, who the Ba'ath Party was part of Saddam, have been eliminated, and now the Sunnis are with ISIS, ISIS, and, oh, tell us about that.
Certainly. What we call the War on Terror is actually a civil war within Islam itself. This is a war in which the radical elements, mostly Sunnis, are trying to drive out both the Shia, who are in charge of the Iraqi government, and the moderate Sunnis, who just don't want to go along. This has been going on for some time, and it will, is likely to go on for some time to come.
So right now, what we can assume is that there's still chaos in Fallujah. Is that right?
Well, this chaos in Fallujah, if you are not a member of the Salafi movement, that's what they call themselves, the pure followers of Islam, but it's firmly in control of ISIS.
And they are, oh, they're brutal. And all this, I think all this turmoil has left such a vacuum in that country that all this openings for these extremist groups and rather than the middle ground. We've got about 30 seconds. Dale, do you have something to add, be real quick, for 30 seconds on this?
No, I think thanks for coming in on Veterans Radio. But I'm saying when he comes back, I'd like to talk a little bit about, what's happened in the last 10 years and how we left it and how this whole thing has evolved over time.
Okay. All right. Vince, stay with us. We'll be right back after this important message and the news. Okay, we're back on Veterans Radio. Myself and Dale Thronberry. We're talking with Vincent L. Folk, who is the author of The Battle for Fallujah, which covers the occupation, resistance, and stalemate in the war in Iraq. We're back. Dale, you had something.
Well, I just want to clarify for our audience, Vincent, if you could kind of tell them, why was Fallujah so important?
Well, Fallujah was actually the opening round in a series of actions that come to this day. There are actually two battles of Fallujah. One in April of 2004, in which we were prevented from taking over the country, the city, by the local politicians. From there, they in effect created a city-state, a radical Islamic city-state that from which they took over several cities, sent in just a cloud of car bombs and suicide vest bombs into Mosul and to Baghdad. And finally, when we recognized that simply allowing them to have their own little territory, their own city, was actually being used as a base to try to take over the rest of Iraq, we had enough, and we sent in a division and fought a very difficult battle in November of 2004.
Well, but getting back to that, we know that the Sunni residents of Western Anbar desert, they were openly hostile to the Shiite majority, and the Sunni resistance and those of the Shia eager to take over as America's left, they started, you ready for this, folks, asymmetrical warfare. Tell us about that, Vince.
Sure. The Iraqis' resistance very quickly understood that to take on the American military force on force was just impossible. The American military is still the American soldier, is still the most lethal combat force in the world. There's no one to be messed with. So what they did was they stopped attacking the Americans directly and started attacking the people. That became the target. They would do ambushes, they would do suicide attacks, they would do hit-and-run rocket attacks and roadside bombs all designed not to fight U.S. forces head-on-head, but to hit and run.
And where were the Kurds in all this?
Well, the Kurds were actually our greatest ally. The Kurds would just as soon leave Iraq and create their own country. They're the largest minority in the world that does not and never has had its own country.
And why is that?
Well, they speak a separate language. They actually, the Kurdish Kurdistan, if you would draw a line where the Kurds are a majority of population, it would include part of northern Iraq, northern Iran, southern Turkey, and eastern Syria. All those countries are determined not to allow Kurdistan to form their own nation. They have been very patient with us and been a pretty good ally. And believe me, from personal experience, they're very brave soldiers.
Are we arming them?
To date, we have been arming them. It's been difficult because, for political reasons, we have to send the guns and ammunition to Iraq first, the Iraqi government first, and then they are supposed to send them to the Kurds. That has not worked out very smoothly.
And why is that?
Well, the Iraqi Arabs do not want the Kurds to separate away from their country. That would be a good sized slice of Iraq going away. That's sort of like asking the United States to give up Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona, for example. So they're not about to let the Kurds get to the point where they can become an independent country. By the way, a very large percentage of, say, about 10 to 15% of all Turkish, are actually Kurds. So the Turks are very concerned about an independent Kurdistan.
Are you getting all this, folks? Are you understanding all this geography? Dale's got his computer open. Dale, what have you found?
I'm just going back here and talking. This Battle of Fallujah, as I mentioned earlier, I've been very fortunate to have a number of Iraqi veterans in my classes, and quite a few of them fought in Anbar province and in Fallujah. And, you know, they're so proud of what they accomplished while they were there. But they're so frustrated now at what is occurring. And I was wondering if you could kind of comment on that, the whole idea of of Fallujah kind of falling into the hands of the bad guys again. And I don't know, you know, we've had other people on. So what's the Iraqi government to do about these people?
Well, I know what our strategy is. Our strategy is to rearm the Iraqi military, which fundamentally collapsed last mm-hmm. year, actually collapsed in this year, and then send them back into Fallujah once they're strong enough. Most likely, Fallujah will be the secondary attack. They have to recover the major city up in the north of Mosul, mm-hmm. Which they also lost. And to give you some idea, Mosul is about the size of, say, Cleveland, Ohio.
Well,
okay. So a little over a million, right?
It's closer to 3 million. Okay. Used to be.
Well, then
now.
I think that we could look at Fallujah as like the Bastogne of the Middle East. Is that correct? It seems like everything goes to there.
Yeah, Fallujah is a unique, a real city because, was about 250,000 people. I don't know how many people are living there now because it has no electricity, no sewer, as in, Mosul up to the north. Most of the moderate Arabs have fled. And so it's probably far reduced in population. Traditionally, Fallujah, which was called the City of Mosque, was a moderate area. It was a Sufi area and not very inclined to follow the radical views of ISIS. That was what Petraeus so effectively exploited during the quote surge period, when they also created the Sons of Iraq, which were tribal Sunnis Arabs who did not take to the radical views of the people like ISIS.
Now, the second battle, there were two, there probably were more, but they've identified two major. The second battle of Fallujah was known as Operation Phantom Fury. The first occurred in April of 2004. That's when the Blackwater, I believe there were four Blackwater employees, contractors, consultants out there that were burned and blown up, and it was quite a deal. And then there was a quick lull, and then we get back into November, is that correct, of 2004 for Operation Phantom Fury. Is that right?
That's correct. In effect, what happened was not only was there a problem with those four Blackwater contractors, but there was a series of events leading up to it where things were going downhill fast. The people who had control of Fallujah were the 82nd Airborne, who had left just prior to that incident. About 2 weeks before the battle, the Marines came in, and the Marines had a different view of how to deal with the insurgency. It was a much more populated-centric view. They intended to use pinpoint raids. They intended to ease off on the heavy hand. And then that ambush of four Blackwater contractors happened. And it really aggravated the situation in Baghdad. General Sanchez, who was in charge, was just outraged. He says, "We've got to get these guys." Now, the Marines asked him to hold off, but he overrode them, and he ordered that they start really the first battle of Fallujah.
Now, we were mostly battling in Fallujah. Were they organized, or how was the combat situation there?
Well, there were anywhere from 500 to 1,000, we're not sure on these, of radicals. These belonged to an organization called at the time AQI, Al-Qaeda of Iraq, and was under a control of a person by the name of Zarqawi, who was a notorious terrorist.
We got him, right? We got him?
Yeah, we finally got him.
Okay.
In fact, but he was so radical that Al-Qaeda disowned him because he was going after the Shia with car bombs and ruining the relationship between Al-Qaeda and the Shia. And so he sort of went off on his own, and he terrorized the Fallujah residents so badly that eventually Petraeus was able to exploit that.
And during, you wrote here that during the Battle of Fallujah, the Second Battle of Fallujah in November of 2004, that Al-Zaghir, I got to get this guy, Zarqawi, that he was not there. It was local insurgents. And is that true? Did he flee ahead of time?
Yes. He had gone north.
Sounds like a coward.
The Sunni, well, he had gone north in the Sunni triangle. You're right. It was a cowardice act. It was clear that we were coming, and we were coming with force. One of the things that we did to protect the local population, that was a big problem in the first battle, was that the local population got in the way of the fighting. In effect, we warned them and warned them and warned them and let the population out. And then we took the city, which greatly reduced the civilian casualties. Of course, by doing so, we lost all surprise, and the leadership left foolish.
Okay, we're coming up on the three-quarter mark of our program. Time's going by very fast. So let's hit our next spot for our latest, the new arrival of sponsorship, Conway Truckload. Conway Truckload honors the service of American military men and women with an apprenticeship program that allows veterans to use the GI Bill to supplement their income during their first year driving, as well as tuition reimbursement when they begin. Conway Truckload wants to continue the tradition of service right here at home. To learn more, call 866-WORK-FOR-US or visit online truetoblue.com/military. Wow, Dale. Wow, Conway Truckload. That is one of the fastest growing occupations. My mother used to say, you got to get an education, you're going to become a truck driver. Well, you know what? I tell you, I got an education, and those guys are doing a heck of a lot more than I'm doing. What about that, Dale?
I don't know about that, but it looks like a pretty good occupation to me right now, too. The neat thing about Conway Truckload is that they are offering these programs to veterans, and they're going to utilize their GI Bill money to get the training that they need to get their CDL license, I guess is what it is, and also supplement their pay while they're kind of going through an apprenticeship before they're set out on a road on their own. I think it, and then if they have experience driving already in the military, they're going to get paid a little bit more.
A little bit more. And it's for men and women. That's right. Let's hear that. Let's hear it. That's right. Men and women. So if you know a veteran, man or woman, that would like to get that opportunity, maybe check that out. You want them to go to Conway Truckload. You see their trucks all over the place. Conway Truckload. And go online, True, T-R-U-E, to the letter, the number 2. True, the number 2, and then blue, blue.com/military. Boy, that should work really cool. So we'll be right back. Yeah, and we are back on Veterans Radio. Vince, your book, The Battle for Fallujah, Occupation, Resistance, and Stalemate in the War in Iraq, Vincent L. Falk. Why did you write that?
Well, I wrote it really for two reasons. One, I wanted the readers to understand what the common soldier faced. Because suddenly the American soldier who was superb in facing against the best armies in the world suddenly found themselves in a situation where they had to adapt, and they adapted magnificently, but at great hardship upon themselves. The second is that Fallujah was the model that ISIS later used to try to take over all of Iraq and all of Syria. Much of what they learned came from this battle. They learned to stay away from American troops, and two, wherever there was weakness on the part of local troops, then that's where they would hit. And you're seeing that even today. Now, we have our ways that we're putting together to counteract it. It's just going to take some time.
And your publisher is McFarland Press. What do they call themselves? McFarland. McFarland. The Battle for Fallujah. And I don't think there's anything. 240 pages. Folks, you want to, you know, it's nice reading. It's got a great cover. It's got lots of maps and tons of pictures and a lot of information. So you'll want to pick that up, The Battle for Fallujah. And I'm speaking right now, Veterans Radio, with Vincent L. Falk. By the way, if you go to our website, veteransradio.net, and go to the bookstore, click on the tab that says bookstore, buy the book, and we can, through PayPal, you know, we get a little bit of that, helps us for our general, for our budget. So go to Veterans Radio, that book will be available, The Battle for Fallujah. All right, Vincent, we've got about 10 minutes, and I want to go over what you outlined here, and I want you to touch on it. These little items. Number one, the ingenuity of the common soldier. Tell us about that.
Yes, when the soldiers got there, they were mostly in the rear troops. They had unarmored vehicles. They were all soft skinned, It took us several years before we came up with the necessary armor with the MRAPs to deal with the roadside bombs and ambushes. But the common soldier didn't wait. What he did was he came up with his own armor. Sometimes they called it hillbilly armor or Haji armor. They would armor up their vehicles themselves. Also, we
with what?
Developed.
What they do
with whatever they could find. In some cases, it was as basic as getting MRE boxes and filling up full of sand. In other cases, it was going out and buying, hiring local people to literally bolt on armor into their Humvees or trucks.
We had a woman on our program, I think, Dale, was about 2005, 2004, the mother who had, she was on our program, she had plates made, I don't know how big, 24 inches by 20, and had them sent to her son for the floorboard on his Humvee because they didn't have any armor on the floor, and that was her way, so she was also contributing. It sounds like this ingenuity thing is the American way. I even saw that on some old World War II black and white where the American Sherman tanks, boy, they put everything in front. So that's just very common practice. Dale, do you have anything to say about that of the American military? What did you do with your helicopter?
No. Let's not talk about thin-skinned. But I do remember that story where the woman sent the armor plating, and they were gathering. They had fundraisers to purchase it on the side and send it over to the troops. So I think, as Vince adequately has pointed out, that we really weren't prepared for the battles when we first got there, especially for them to be so so strong, I guess you could say, and so many bombs going off everywhere. And I was interested in what you said in your book about the transition of the American troops to fighting this battle, and how you were able to, to solve what was happening there in Fallujah. Could you talk just a little bit about how the Battle of Fallujah eventually ended up, and then, because since you were in civil affairs, I want you to talk a little bit about that.
Well, as soon as we realized that giving the fundamentalists their own city-state was not going to work. And that's effectively what we did after the first battle. Because they started this campaign of car bombs. They actually took over the city north of Baghdad called Samarra. We turned the tables. First of all, we took back Samarra in a very tough battle, and it became the rehearsal for the Battle of Fallujah. That's where we learned to get the civilian population out of the way, and it worked. Second of all, we made good use of our allies, the Iraqi allies. We retrained them, and we did not send them up in the front. We saved that for our troops, because they're so much better trained and the lethality of our troops were much better. We used them as to follow up to hold the territory that we took. We developed a number of tactics some of which were controversial.
Like what?
For example,
what's controversial?
We used artillery, but we used the tactics were called shake and bake. We would use artillery phosphorus rounds to set fire to the buildings. They weren't aimed at troops. They were aimed at setting fires to the buildings. Then we would drive, that would drive the enemy out of those buildings where we could take them on an even fight. Of course, anytime you're taking on American troops on an even fight, it's not that even. The other tactics we used is we realized that the real target here, the real center of gravity, was the people, not the territory. And that's where organizations such as the Civil Affairs became so important, because the rebuilding effort to rebuild Fallujah after we took it was considered equally important to taking the city in the first place. And so long as we were there to sort of protect the Sunnis from the Shia, it worked out very well. It only started to fall apart as soon as we left.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we've got about 2.5 minutes. I want to touch on this very quickly. You mentioned this because it changed socially in the military, the presence of women in combat. We've got about 2 minutes. Touch on that, Vince.
Yes, women played a higher percentage of the troops in combat than they had ever seen in before. In fact, shortly thereafter, after the second battle in March, we saw our first Silver Star winner that won the Silver Star in close combat, a young sergeant by the name of Leanne Hester, who was assigned to the 617th Military Police Company, Kentucky National Guard Organization. She led a squad of 2 women and 8 men in 3 Humvees that was following a truck company, and she took on 50 insurgent fighters that ambushed the company. So she was outnumbered, but they managed to drive off those insurgents. In this case, they were members of the Mahdi army. These were Shia militia.
Well, I want to tell all those Neanderthals out there that were saying, well, women aren't strong enough, and you know what? That's my response to those, because women did do what they had to do, and they stepped up, and that's what's written. So did the men, and so did all the military. Dale, you got something? You got less than a minute? Nope, Dale's shaking his head. He wants to say goodbye to everybody. Right, Dale?
Is it that time already?
Yes, I know. And Vince, thank you very much for being a guest on our program, The Battle for Fallujah Occupation, Resistance, and Stalemate in the War in Iraq. Vincent L. Foulk, The Battle for Fallujah. You want to get it, Vince? Thank you very much for being our guest. And sharpen your snow shovel. We'll talk to you again sometime. Is that cool?
Yes, thank you.
Oh, God bless. Whew. What? And they're going to get 2 feet of snow. It's coming. Anyway.
It's winter.
That's the music. And until next week, this is Bob Gould, Dale Thronberry, and you are dismissed, man.